Hey everyone, welcome back to Buzzworthy. I'm your host, Schleicy Harris. I dive into the rare stories entrepreneurs tell about building their businesses, but most importantly, themselves. Let's get into it. Hey everyone, welcome back to Buzzworthy. I'm your host, Schleicy Harris, and in the studio today we have Ariella Rocco, co-founder of CoLab Education. Welcome to the studio, Ariella.
Thank you for having me.
I am very, very excited to talk to you because you're in a space that I sort of know a lot about, in sort of a back end way. Just from my whole life lived experience.
I know. That's why I am very excited to chat about that. And that is the thing, when you talk about education, everybody leans in because they have a story. They have, you know, your own experience as a student.
Yeah.
Firstly, but then everybody has a family member, a friend, a relative, a colleague who works in the education space, and everyone has a lot of opinions about it too.
Oh yeah. I was going to say that the opinions are, you know, long. I mean, I have a lot of them too, but you know, before you even like got to becoming a teacher and then jumping onto this entrepreneurial journey, like, what do you think set you up to say, I'm going to take the leap of faith and go fix this problem?
Well, I don't think I was trying to solve big, big problems, quite honestly, in the early stages of my career. I just really found, hey, you know what? I'm catching my stride working with students and kids. And I love the dynamic energy of being in a space. I was a camp counselor. I was a nanny for many years and just like, loved that environment. Mm-hmm. And it's like, I don't think I could work in a space where I'm clocking in, working at a desk and theoretically solving problems or theoretically engaging with the world. I want to be in it. I want to be engaged. I want to laugh every day. I want to do all these fun and enjoyable things and work with kids in a meaningful way. And I think that's what kind of set me off on the path of obviously being a teacher. And then it wasn't until I lived a lot of the challenges of what that meant that I thought, oh, yes, we all know that there's problems in education. I quite honestly just often just said, it's a system problem. There's nothing that I can do. The system is what it is. And it's the system people's problem to fix. Yeah. But when you're in a system, you're all part of the system. So that made me really feel, you know what, I have agency and I have the ability to take a swing at solving some of the challenges, not all of the challenges. Yeah. And I think we should all have that mentality instead of offloading problems onto other people. If there is something we can do in our context, mm-hmm. I think it is up to us. We have to create the future we want. No one else is doing it for us, right?
Yeah. I loved everything you just said. And it makes me want to ask the question of, like, have you always sort of viewed the world that way? Or when did you start to view the world that way?
Good question. I don't know. I feel like I've become more reflective in recent years because I get questions like this. But I don't know, to be honest, if I were to answer that, practically. I don't know. I feel like I like to solve problems.
Yeah.
I do complain a lot. Friends and family, they know. But often if I'm complaining, it's because I'm trying to kind of process and get through the muck of it to get onto the other side of, okay, what are we going to do next? Mm-hmm. I think that's a fair judgment of who I am as a person. And the colleagues that I've worked with too know that. If I'm like, hey, if when I was a teacher, I've got all these challenges and I've got a student in my class who I'm not breaking through to, or I tried this thing and it failed. Mm-hmm. Help me get through this. Help me figure out the next steps. It was all in a pursuit of solving problems. So I guess that is sort of how I'm wired. I didn't really realize that, but it's true. Yeah.
You were talking about that, it made me also ask another question. Is like, who was Ariella on the playground?
Oh.
Like, what role did you have on the playground?
I like this.
Because I think that could say so much about you.
It could. Okay, so I'm trying to think. Bring myself back. I went to a fairly small kind of like one hallway Catholic elementary school for the first chunk of my life from kindergarten to grade 8 in Halton District. And I had a lot of friends that were consistent through many years. I was also a French immersion kid, but we had a pretty big, I'm thinking of like the playground space. We had a pretty big playground with a big field and some tarmac area. And I feel like I was just up to weird things. I feel like I'm an imaginative person. Mm-hmm. I often think of my more middle school days where you're just kind of running around and screaming because that's fun to do with your friends. But if I think younger, I can remember a lot of just funny things, getting into trouble, being creative with the things that we had. I don't remember having a lot of toys or like equipment out there. I think it was just us and the elements. Yeah.
I have just like, you know, if I try to imagine like younger Ariella on the playground, it's kind of, I feel like you were probably that person that was organizing all things and making sure people were following the rules, but also like breaking some of the rules yourself.
That is me now. Like, okay. I will actively say, I think one of my favorite things to do is bring friends and family together for organized games. Mm-hmm. Most of my birthday parties have some sort of high commitment threshold. If you're coming, we're going to be playing this game, or you need to dress up in a costume because my birthday's around Halloween. With family gatherings, we often do little games and things. And I do like to set people up for these experiences, which is totally the role of an educator, is you are the guide on the side. Like, you're not supposed to be at the front telling people what to do, but you're supposed to be crafting these learning experiences and learning moments. And I feel totally, I see that now in myself in many facets of my life. As a kid, I'm not sure if it came across, maybe I was just really bossy. I'm not sure how it came across at that age. I know I had friends, so that's cool. People were aligned with me. Mm-hmm. But I don't remember being so much of a ringleader. And I feel like I was a little bit more like go with the flow back then. And now as I get older, I feel like I'm like, someone's going to take charge and it's going to be me.
It's going to be me. I'm going to do it. I mean, there's nothing wrong with that, you know?
No, it's
But I think sometimes, like, who we are as kids, like, sometimes very much reflects who we are as adults. Mm-hmm. Like, those core components rarely change.
Yeah.
Because I think I look at myself, and when I think back, like, who I am today is probably exactly who I was from just, like, a core fundamental perspective, very much the same person.
Well, I was going to ask you the same question about what were you like out there on the playground and out with your friends as a young kid? And do you see those same traits now moving forward? Yeah?
Yeah, 100%. That's exactly why I think 4-year-old Shalicia is basically today's Shalicia in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
Like, I love to have fun. I love to laugh. You know, I love to like organize and do all of the things, mm-hmm. To make sure that everybody's having fun. But also at the end of it all, I don't have specific memories of just this, but at the end of all of it, I would sit back and be like, I did that.
That's so sweet. And that's, I mean, it is, some people will say, you know, what they feel like they've transformed really dramatically, like who they were in the past is mm-hmm. nothing like who they are today. And it surprised them and people that know them. Yeah. But I feel like the more common answer is there's these core fundamental things that sort of
live through
it. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, totally agree. I mean, let's get back on track. That was
That was track.
That was like a little sidetrack. So what was, you know, in as you were a teacher, you decided to become a teacher and you were teaching. Tell us about your teaching career a little bit.
Yeah, so it took me a little bit of time to figure out that I wanted to pursue teaching. Again, like I said, I really enjoyed working with kids in different capacities, but I didn't see it as a career potential. Then I did a lot of that traditional kind of career exploration that you do in high school, and I did some teaching placements and really solidified, hey, this is something that I would love and I would be really good at. And I went to McGill for my undergrad, and I really loved that program there because it was a 5-year B.Ed. with many classroom placements. So I was in, because I was in elementary program, I was in kindergarten all the way up to grade 6. Mm-hmm. in Montreal in various different classroom settings. I got a lot of hands-on experience thrown out there a lot of the time where my classroom teacher just said, it's your class today, go for it. And I was teaching, you know, grade 4 math, and I had to come up with grade 5 English lessons and run a science lesson for grade 1 on roots and plants. I remember these things really vividly because there's like funny stories attached to almost everything when it comes to teaching. And it really made me feel like, okay, I know I'm in the right space. I know I like working with some of the older kids because their sense of humor is superb. They just, you can talk a lot with them. You can reason with them. You can critically think and go a little bit deeper into some of the concepts and ideas, but ultimately they're still forming their perceptions of the world and what they care about. And I really like that. So I ended up teaching middle school at a teacher's college. And I taught math and science, which surprisingly were my worst subjects growing up. I feel like that made me quite attuned to the kids who were struggling and the kids who were, you know, just staring into the distance. And instead of saying, oh, well, they don't get it, let's move on, I think I would pay a little bit extra attention to those kids and say, hey, I get it. Trust me, like, this is not resonating with you. This doesn't make sense. Like, let's review. Let's take more time. Let's find a different way to like bring you on board. Yeah. And so, yeah, that was my experience for several years. And I really enjoyed teaching in various different places. I taught in public schools, independent schools, and then internationally, I taught in Spain for a year, which is a really cool experience. So, but all with that same age group and teaching various courses.
Yeah. And what was the challenge that eventually led to CoLab that you experienced over and over again that said, I've got to fix this?
It's a hard answer, or a hard question to answer, because I think there's a lot of facets to it. I would say the biggest challenge for me was I felt like my network was really limited as a teacher, which maybe sounds like a small problem, but it's painful in how it pans out. So for the average teacher, you work in a school with, if you're lucky, a couple colleagues or like your coworkers.
Like that, 10, 15?
Three.
Oh, you mean in terms
in
of like
who what you're teaching?
Engaged with.
Yes. Okay, yes. Okay. You absolutely have a bigger set of colleagues, unless you're at a micro school. But yes, you're, like the schools I taught at had 70 staff members. And so that was wonderful. And we had a great community of people that worked at the school. But as far as people you need to work with every single day, those are the people who teach the same subjects as you and who work in the same grade level as you. Mm-hmm. So if I'm teaching, you know, middle school, if I'm teaching grade 6 science, for example, I would have one or two or three other people that I worked with who also taught the same subject. And of course, you can relate to other people in the school, but it's really important to work with those people who teach the same thing as you, because you are constantly adapting the curriculum and you're obviously adapting your assessments. Curriculum changes from the provincial level, but it also comes down to the world is changing and we're not bound to just what's getting printed out for us from, you know, the standard curriculum. We're trying to meet the needs of students right here, right now in our class. And so when things happen, like the explosion of AI and kids are using that for assessments and thinking and creativity and how that changes the world, we need to be responsive right away in a class. You don't have time to wait until the curriculum catches up. So all this to say is when you have a limited network and you have a couple people that you work with to teach, those people, no matter how great, and I had the best colleagues, many of them are still great friends, it means that you just have less people to kind of brainstorm with, less people to bounce ideas off of, and practically less people to get the work done. So if you're taking a whole unit or a whole year of content and curriculum and learning and revamping it, that's hundreds of lessons, hundreds of assessments. Like, it's so much work. And the job of a teacher, the in-person stuff, like how you're engaging with students and the way you show up and the way you support them, is probably over 50% of what it means to be an educator, is just the way that you interact and guide students and connect with them, listen to them, relate to them. Yeah. But a lot of it is still about how are you bringing in these learning moments, the curriculum, the content, exploration, all these different subjects, and making it meaningful and impactful and something that's going to help guide them into the next steps of their life. And as a middle school teacher, we're not teaching content so that they can go off the next year and study that in college or university. I actually think middle school is a great year because it's the formative year where they're figuring out, what are the things that excite me? Like, what are the subjects or the topics? I'm like, I'm curious. I want to know more. And I think that is the power of education. It lets people get excited about, oh, I want to learn more about photosynthesis, or I want to learn more about the human brain, or I want to learn more about the world and literature and cultures of the world or languages and all these different topics, right? So back to the question about the problem is, a lot of teachers are lucky to have a couple colleagues. Most are working alone at their school. And so they have a lot of content to create, a lot of learning moments to create with materials to create for their students. They're trying to keep up with the demands of what it means to be relevant and make learning meaningful and differentiate it for your students. Classrooms of today, people will argue, are way more diverse than they ever were. I'm not so sure if that's true. I think we just better understand the diversities that are in our classrooms now. Like, we have more labels and more language around the way people think
themselves in the world.
Exactly. And I'm not so sure what the right way there is. Like, I don't know if it's better.
I don't know if there is a right way.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah.
But I do think that we have more language to understand, okay, some people think differently or process information differently, or some people struggle in these areas or have exceptionalities in these areas. And now that we know this information and we have more understanding on how people learn, how people develop and grow, it is the role of a teacher to adapt to everybody as much as possible to make sure that they're not left out and they don't feel like this isn't for them. And that is the challenge of teaching in general. So there's so many different people that you're trying to engage with. So with all that on the table, I think most educators are just finding it really hard, overwhelming, to meet the needs of their students and to feel like they're successfully engaging with their students and giving them what they need, both in the classroom and just as a human being.
So do you think it's, you know, obviously classroom sizes are a concern today.
Yep.
Because we have less and less teachers retaining the job long term, right?
Yes. So that's
what's the sad around that?
Well, that's the ultimate sort of goal of what we're trying to solve. Is the stat that I kind of anchor to, but I think it changes, is around 25% to 40% of teachers quit within the first 5 years. So there are still people going through teachers college, although that is reducing.
Yes.
So yes, people might still see this as a viable career choice. They go to teachers college, they get certified, they go out into the classroom, they teach, they might stick around for a year, 3 years, 5 years, and then figure out, oh, this is not going to work for me. Not because they're not super passionate about the job, not because they were confused at what it meant to be a teacher and they got bamboozled. It's the job is feeling impossible. And that really upsets me. And I'm going to cry because I feel like it should be possible for people to be amazing at their job. And if, I don't know if this probably will be cut.
That's okay.
But like, if teachers quit, then who is there for the students? Like,
100%.
Ultimately.
I personally agree with you. And I think maybe that could be a bit of a bias because both my parents are teachers.
Yes.
And I've seen the work that my mom specifically puts into how she creates these environments because she's an elementary school teacher.
Yeah.
So the way you create and teach and run your classroom is very different than the way a high school teacher would do it. But still, they need this level of, like you said, the human understanding of the child and the children in the classroom, how that specific collection of kids come together and what does that make the classroom look and feel like? And then how do you resonate with all of these kids on a one-to-one basis, but also as an entire group?
Yeah.
And I think exactly what you're saying is, like, how do you create that network where people can tap into the other resources that other teachers have to make learning fun and exciting again for kids is really missing. And I remember, you know, even days helping my mom, you know, make posters and full body cutouts.
That's so always the story. If you have a teacher in your family, whether you're a kid or a partner of a teacher, you're like a teacher family, really, because there's a lot of work that comes home, which is not a good thing, but there's a lot of work that comes home. And it means that it becomes a family affair of, okay, we're now all cutting out letters and we all need to come up with interesting ideas or go to the store and buy more materials. And some of that is indicative of the problems that we have to solve in education. Like if educators don't have the time in their workday to do their job, that's not ideal. If they don't have the resources in the buildings and they need to go out and buy or make things themselves. Like these surface bigger challenges, but they can also be fond memories of, this is something that a lot of teachers are willing to do because they know ultimately it's going to benefit the student. So they'll do it. Some just feel they can't keep doing it.
Yeah.
And I think that's what's kind of hitting this mark. But I think to your point of what teachers are really asking for is not just like, hey, I want to chat with another teacher. Yes, teachers love to yap generally. They're chatty people. And they like to relate to people and connect. But it's more about, okay, if you ask a teacher, what do they need? It's usually, I need more resources. And resources can mean many different things for many different people. It can mean physical things in their classroom, books, pencils, erasers, paper towels. But it could also mean things like the curriculum documents that we're given or the materials that we teach and learn with are outdated or they're not relevant. They aren't engaging students. You'd be surprised the amount of people who are working from either textbooks or workbooks that just aren't it anymore. And teachers are like, well, this is what I was given to teach with, but it's not relevant. It doesn't match where we're going with the curriculum and with our students. And so that needs a lot of work. And all various other things in between. So teachers will always say, I just don't feel like I have enough resources. And if you dig deeper, it's, I don't feel like I have the specific resources I need. Mm-hmm. Some schools you can see they're more barren, like they simply do not have a lot of things in the classrooms for students. But others are more like, I've been given materials and resources, but they don't match what I need for my students. They don't match what I need as a professional. I might be 25 years into the career and I already have a basic understanding of, you know, the science of reading, but I need something new or different.
Could you give us like some concrete examples? Like walk us through like what were some of the big things you were missing in your career at the beginning? Sort of, I know you were sort of in the middle when you sort of stepped away from it to do this. But what were some of the things that the resources that you really needed as a teacher to thrive?
For me, it was, I taught at very resourced schools generally, and I had a lot of the teaching and learning materials that I needed on hand. It was more the people resources that I felt like I was missing. Again,
what would that be?
People to talk with and ask them for their perspective, their feedback, and their ideas. Mm-hmm. And so, like I said, I would work on these small teams that were great, and we would all try to divide and conquer and get things done when it came to creating new lessons and new slide decks and new assessments. But our perspective was also limited, and I think of one example always is when I was teaching grade 8 science, we were changing the curriculum with me and two other educators who had way more experience than me to a project-based learning curriculum. Mm-hmm. And we were not new to this concept. This had been around for ages. There were books, there are conferences, there are podcasts on how to teach project-based learning specifically for the Ontario Science grade 8 curriculum. Mm-hmm. But we just didn't have those resources in-house. We didn't have people who had done that before. We didn't have of course, we could go and buy a book, but once you do that, it's more about practically, how does this work?
Yes.
Right? And so we would try to go out and find those resources on our own and get out to a conference or meet with somebody. But with a limited schedule of a teacher and just not having those available to you at a given time,
there's no bandwidth to actually do that.
Yeah, it was up to us to go out and figure it out And I often felt like, you know, this seems like a miss because whatever we come to that we're really happy about as a group of three is probably good, but is it great? We haven't done this yet. If we could talk to another group of teachers at a different school down the road who had already tried and experimented with this change and these types of lessons and learning experiences that we were striving towards, we could just ask them, hey, what failed? What worked? What didn't? What would you recommend? And then it would help our process and it would feel less like a slog and like we were starting, like we weren't starting from scratch, that we were starting from a place where other people had put in work to get somewhere.
Learning, right?
Of course.
Because like this person did it first. You don't have to reinvent the wheel. And so I guess that's where sort of collab comes in, right? So how does collab, you know, sort of solve this problem of having a strong network and an opportunity for career development and learning and thinking outside the box to like bring students better learning experience?
Yeah, so that's a great way to summarize it. And it's a lot. It's a hefty goal that we're trying to achieve, but we are trying to give K-12 teachers across the world, we're starting here in North America, with real-time access to other professionals, so building out their network so they can find another teacher in a different school or in a different district that they can message and ask for feedback, that they can share a question with or share resources with. So that real-time, I need this person or I need this thing and I know where to get it, that's one component. And then the other component is the differentiated piece. Everybody needs something different at every stage of their career. Mm-hmm. 1 year, their focus might be on readapting their curriculum based on the new expectations. Mm-hmm. The next year, they might have a student who has a very particular need that they haven't worked with yet before. And they're trying to understand, how do I work with a student? How do I make the learning meaningful? How do I engage with them? How do I speak and talk with their parents? Or what other services beyond the school are available for their mental health or their physical health? Like that real-time differentiated network and support is what we're hoping to achieve with Collab. And so
then what is Collab exactly? Is it a platform? Is it a networking? Is it a resource? Like how would you define Collab in terms of a thing, so we could know, like, it's a website, it's an app I download.
Yes.
Like, what?
I'm burying the lead, basically. It is a platform. Yeah. It's an online platform. And when I started trying to solve this problem, I didn't have an app in mind. I didn't have a specific technology. It really was born because of all the conversations that I had with teachers sharing that they want to build their network. They want differentiated and accessible resources that are high quality, but they want them from beyond their own classroom or their beyond their own school walls. They want to connect with people in all different places who are on all different busy, crazy schedules, and they need to be able to connect. And so that's where technology is obviously the answer is great. We can connect across school walls at any time of day, whenever we need, and broaden networks and expand the opportunity and access to resources. So it's an online platform. It is entirely free for teachers to use. So we have an open source community space where you can create your professional profile, similar to LinkedIn. People will say, hey, this kind of sounds like LinkedIn for teachers. And there's many things that we're trying to do to bring that networking vibe to the teaching profession. There's a place for you to share and exchange free resources with each other. It can be things that you have created yourself. It can be things that you have found useful from other websites. And you're basically saying, hey, I've grabbed this thing from TVO Learn, for example. I use this in my grade 2 class, and here's why it worked. And here's how I connected it to XYZ unit and why it was successful. Let's talk about it. And if you have questions, you know where to find me. You can reach me here. You can message me. So we're trying to build that network. And it has a social element to our platform. That's honestly the core piece in teaching is, if you think about it, a lot of people have resources. Every teacher has a Google Drive or a binder or something. They may not want to share those resources for a bunch of different reasons. Yeah. They might feel, you know what, I haven't built a relationship with other people where I feel comfortable in sharing those resources. Mm-hmm. Or if I do, I want it to be an exchange. Like, you're giving me something and I'm giving you something and we're working together instead of just putting things out there for people to take.
So I guess what would be the new incentive for them to share now?
Well, that's the thing, is we are working with teachers who already have the community mentality. Mm-hmm. So our first group of users, since we've been around for a couple years in development and a year of active usage on our platform, it's the people who understand, hey, I know how hard it is to be a teacher. I know how hard it is to create and time intensive it is to create resources from scratch. I'm willing to share my stuff, my ideas, open up the things that I've created to help another teacher. Mm-hmm. So that's sort of the first group of users. They're just mission aligned. They get the community vibe and they want to share.
That's what every founder needs, though.
Yes.
Because, like, you have to create kind of your own cult following so that if these people really believe in you, they're going to be invested in helping you solve this problem further and help you uncover problems that you didn't even know actually existed.
100%.
Yeah.
We say we're for teachers by teachers, and mm-hmm. it sounds nice, but it's more than that. It's mm-hmm. the amount of teachers that I've talked to and worked with in my own network to start, obviously, is just who are the colleagues and people that I know who are teachers. And now it's expanded around the world to teachers who reach out to us constantly, not just with their feedback about what they like about the platform, but where, like, their big, big dreams are. And even some of the features we co-built with teachers who we said, hey, if you're willing to sit in a couple calls, or you're willing to draft up some ideas, or you're willing to share things in an email, which is a lot to ask of a teacher who is already overloaded, we've had a lot of people respond and tell us, yes, we really care about this. We want teachers to feel like they have support and a network, and they want to be a part of the solution. So they're helping us build it, and they're taking time to help us craft every feature, every next step in our process, even how we engage with teachers and who we talk to next. Mm-hmm. They have referred us to their principal or to their colleagues to spread the word. And that's ultimately been what's kept us going and enabled us to keep running and expanding. I think we've probably, if you come onto our platform today, there's lots of great features. Our team has done a wonderful job of building with our first feedback in mind and getting things off the ground and iterating quickly to meet the needs of the teachers, the principals, the superintendents, and all the people in the education ecosystem that we're supporting. But you will see, and I feel like we've probably hit 5-10% of our target. Yeah. And so we're constantly asking people, what else do you want to see? What's exciting to you next? Mm-hmm. Where do you want this to go? And I feel like we have a huge and exciting runway ahead of us. And it's only possible because people actually see this as a very important issue and challenge to solve. And they're really dedicated in this being that solution. So they are pooling in, like I said, their time and energy to help us make this possible.
That's amazing. So what have you in building CoLab Education, like, what have you learned about yourself through this journey and what it means to create something out of nothing?
It's been an interesting process because, again, I was really scared when I found out this was going to be technology, because my experience before was working in schools as a teacher. I did try to solve problems for a lot of the time. It was kind of selfish. It was, I just need to solve my problems for me.
Problems we mostly want to solve are selfish, actually.
Yeah.
Because, like, if it weren't, we wouldn't care enough about it.
It's true. You have to feel the pain firsthand, I think, in order for it to be meaningful and worthwhile, and for you to really understand what's the scope of this problem and what are all the things, the factors, the elements that make this problem significant and worth solving. Because there's a million problems in the world. Not all of them maybe are worth solving to the same degree. And so, yeah, it's worth noting that I feel like I had this very selfish mindset at first of just, I want to solve this problem for me. And then I validated that a lot of people had this challenge, and it looked very in various different ways, but it was all ultimately going to be solved by a similar type of solution. So what I learned about myself was, okay, I know what I don't know, which is I knew very quickly that I felt totally fish out of water when it came to building technology, but that I am a user. We all are users of so many different pieces of technology. So we know what works. We know what jives. We know what is ultimately useful for us. And so I tried to put on that hat of like, okay, maybe I don't know the ins and outs of what it takes to build every aspect of this technology platform, which is robust. Like there are many features and many elements that go into this platform. It's not a very simple technology to build, but I knew what it could be like and how it could work and how it could function. And I knew that if I was getting enough feedback from people and working with the best team, that it would all be fine. But I think long story short, what I realized about myself is that I definitely need to have a sense of like confidence in what I'm doing in order to really stamp my name on it. Like I feel like as a teacher, I always felt, even if I didn't know what I was doing, I just went out and found the people or the resources to help me feel comfortable and confident.
Yeah.
And then once I did that, and once I kind of gathered that the team, the resources and the network, which was hard to do, going from like my teaching network to my business network, it's a totally different thing. Yeah. But once I spent time doing that, I was a part of many different accelerator programs and I had various mentors and advisors. And that was my way of building my confidence in what I was capable of doing as a founder and as a CEO and how to drive this business. And once I gained enough of my footing, I felt, okay, now I know that this is a surefire thing, that, and I will be the one to bring this with a team over the edge and into reality and make it possible. Yeah. But I definitely wasn't okay with just sort of slapping things together. I cared too much about the problem for it to be hacked together. Mm-hmm. I needed to have certainty that we could do this and we could do it right, you know?
Yeah. I mean, the one thing about entrepreneurship is that, you know, it lacks a lot of certainty.
Yes. I've learned that.
A lot of certainty. So like, how do you navigate that going, you know, even from day to day or week to week, where it's sometimes just like, I don't know if this thing is going to work, but I'm going to push through it.
Yes. I think that is one of the biggest changes. Teaching is, the role itself is consistent. Like you are on a school schedule. You know your calendar in the summer for the entire year. I know every day that I'm going to have off. I know every hour that I'm going to work. Like those types of things.
Predictable. Yeah.
Highly predictable in that sense. But then the day to day is wildly unpredictable. You're working with people of all different kinds. You don't know what problems are going to arise. And it can be like a zoo sometimes what happens in a school.
Your school was a training ground. Right.
Well, that's what I'm saying. In some ways, there's this hyper predictability about being in an education system, working in a school, and then a lot of unpredictability at the same time. So there's that dichotomy. But then as a founder, yes, it's super unpredictable. Things like your financial stability is also obviously a huge shift. You're like, oh, I don't really know when I'm going to make money myself, or when I'll be able to hire a team, or when we'll be able to get to the next step. Like, these are things I think you take for granted when you work in a stable salary job that has a very clear pathway and trajectory. Yeah. But that being said, I think I took probably the chaotic elements of being a teacher and sort of leaned into that as a founder. We're like, yep, I don't know what today or tomorrow is going to look like, but that's okay. I'm going to adapt on the fly. I'm going to be flexible within reason. But then you have to create the structure yourself as an entrepreneur,
yes.
Right? And I'm working with a really small team. It's myself and our technology team and lots of support from advisors and mentors and, again, the network that I've built. But we're a small team and it's really up to us to figure out, okay, what is our schedule going to look like this week and how are we going to time block? Like there's some practical strategies I've learned that yeah, no one's handing you, here's your schedule. You're teaching from 9 to 10:30 math, and then you're teaching, like, that was all created for me. I just showed up and my day was crafted, yeah, for better or for worse. And now this has made me think a lot more about prioritization, mm-hmm, of, yes, we are solving a very big and hairy problem. And then if you break that down into what do you need to do first, second, and third in order to tackle this today's problem, this week's problem, this month's problem, it is about continuously putting things into perspective and continuously prioritizing.
Yeah.
Which is something I've had to learn to do and gained a lot of tricks along the way.
It's really hard.
I'm sure you can relate. You know, yeah.
What to prioritize, because it feels like sometimes the whole house is on fire. And I actually, this morning, I sort of felt that way. The whole house was on fire. But what really grounded me really quickly was I have this thing where it's actually this book, and I got it from the dollar store, and it says,
great book,
Work Hard, Dream Big. And so I decided that all my problems go inside of this book.
Mm.
And by the time I'm done writing out the problems and what I can learn from them, the dream's going to be bigger outside of it.
Oh, I really like that.
So,
have you always been a journaler or somebody who writes things down as a way to process? So
before, I used to talk people's ear off.
Yep.
And then I realized that I don't have, as we get older in life, we don't have the flexibility to do that all the time to other people, because other people have problems too.
Yeah. Yeah.
Very early on in my entrepreneurial journey, where I was looking for a co-founder, everyone was telling me, you just need one. I was just like so overwhelmed by everyone saying you can't get to whatever next stage unless you have this. No one's going to take you that seriously if you don't have this. And I remember sitting there one night and I just wrote out all the reasons and all the good things a co-founder can bring me, and then all the problems a co-founder, mm-hmm, can, mm-hmm, bring me. And the problems were a lot longer, and I was just like, what problems can I live with? What problems can I live without? And I just went through this like elimination process, and I realized by the end of it, even though I didn't have an answer to anything, I just felt better.
I just
felt better because the problem was identified. The problem was very specific. I mean, a long list of specifics. But it was just a way to extract it out of my mind and into a real format. And so the relief I sort of got just from the verbal vomit onto the pages just felt so much better, that every time I have a problem that sort of, ruminates in the back of my mind. Like, ruminating is one thing that I'm really trying to get rid of.
Yeah.
I put it on paper, and by the time I'm done with it, and it's always like the good and bad of,
mm-hmm,
it.
Mm-hmm.
And I never come to the conclusion of what is actually going to happen. And so it still leaves a lot of space for magic.
Yeah.
And I mean, me saying that, it feels like, I have a little wand and I'm Harry Potter or something. But I don't know. Like, I just think that, once I get it out, it's out there. I've identified it. I know what I'm afraid of. And once you know what you're afraid of, it's no longer that scary.
Yeah. I really can appreciate that process. I feel like I've learned a little bit more about how that process can work for me, and mm-hmm, whether it's writing down or talking even out loud and like recording things on my phone, but not for anybody, just for me to kind of say it out and then go back and return. I think it's helpful. But the fact, I really like how you said, going into it, you're not trying to solve the problem in that moment.
Yeah.
There's a multi-step process there, and I think that takes a lot of the pressure off yourself of, okay, I need to figure out the answer in this one session of time. It's going to take you know, a lot of reflection, a lot of thought, a lot of care. Mm-hmm. And I think people can take from that too in their life. And I would agree that as somebody who loves to yap and talk a lot, it is hard to find. Everyone has things going on in their life. And sometimes talking is just a way of processing. It doesn't need, you actually don't care that there's somebody there. Sometimes you do. Sometimes you want the feedback and you want the perspective.
You want to feel heard.
Yes.
You know?
Yes. Yeah. But maybe 50% or more is just a way to get things out and to start understanding your fears, your thoughts, and then make more sense of it so you can do something with it. And nobody needs to be there for that. You could just do that on your own.
You can. In a book that no one will ever read.
Hopefully. You should put this in a lock and key and, I don't know, buy a safe. Unless you're writing.
It goes everywhere with me.
So okay.
Like line of sight all the time.
Okay. As somebody who grew up with two sisters and I used to write a little diary. Mm-hmm. They've used that against me multiple times in my life, the things that I'd written in that diary. And I was sneaky with where I hid it and what I did. So I think I just have my backup because I know what people could do damage if they read what was in my book. True. But you know what? You're trusting and go with that.
Yeah. I mean, my circle right now is very, very small, like limited people come into contact with me. And kind of like it.
Nice.
I kind of like it because then I feel like I can be me 100% of the time.
Well, your network is probably very large in the sense that you do podcasts like this and you meet people who you maybe would never ever run into or interact with, but you make these connections and build these relationships with people from all different facets and on their entrepreneurial journey, but in so many different industries and spaces. Yeah. And so all this to say, keep your book close. Very close.
Very, very close. But I think the beauty of it, if a founder found it, I think it'll be the most relatable book they've ever read.
Oh, probably.
Yeah.
Probably.
And I think that's what this whole podcast is about. It's kind of, it's just a space for you as a founder to, you know, reflect on your journey so far. I've had so many people at the end of the podcast say to me, wow, this felt like therapy and I didn't know anything. And it has, that makes me want to keep doing this every time because it answers it to me. It says this was the solution to the problem that you had in not having a co-founder and starting this. So all of my guests in some way, shape or form has inadvertently been a co-founder to me. Let's go back to collab.
Do we have to?
Yeah, you do. Our conversation has been, you know, so refreshing in so many ways and hearing you talk about, you know, your love for teaching. And I think that comes across very, very clearly. But collab recently had a huge success, you know, winning Lion's Lair, which is a pitch competition where you also get, you know, some fiscal support out of that, which is huge for founders.
Yes.
How was that experience pitching and then winning a competition like that?
It was great. I have, throughout this journey, I was talking to somebody the other day because they said, oh, you know, isn't it funny how you don't really realize how often you're going to be in these situations to talk and be on stage. And we were just chit-chatting about that. And I thought, you know what? I remember when I first decided to step out of teaching and into collab, which was a huge leap to begin with. I had the impression that if I'm building technology, I'm behind the scenes. No one will ever know it's me. And I'm just, you know, I can share the ethos of what we're doing, but I won't really have to be out there pitching and talking to all these people. And I'll just be kind of behind making all the magic happen. Mm-hmm. And that very quickly was a lie. I really learned that no, people care about you as a founder, your story, why you're doing this, why it's important, especially at the early stages. Not everybody can or should or will build a business from scratch, and people want to know why you're doing it, why you, how will this work. And to bring on partners and to bring on investors and people who believe in you, they want to understand what your motivations are. And so anyways, all this to say is throughout my journey, I've had to be in these positions where I'm pitching on stage and really, really publicly putting myself out there. And it started off very uncomfortable. I actually, although I was a teacher and I talked a lot with my students, I really hated public speaking to like larger crowds, adults. I'm good with kids, but adults made me really nervous. But the experience beyond just pitching, like the pitching event of Lionslayer was great because there was a room of, I think, 400 or so people in the ecosystem from Halton region. Obviously, it's Hamilton and Burlington based with the Innovation Factory. But there are people that I've met there who are from all over the GTA and Ontario. That exposure is huge for a startup. And just to have people resonate with our mission, feel like they have a way to help us or connect us or come along with us, that has been the ultimate sort of reward. Yes, winning the first place prize means a lot when you're a startup and you have bills to pay and you have things you want to do and the extra money helps you get there faster. Yeah. But really, and a shout out to the sponsors of that event, because the fact that they will put their money behind early stage founders means a lot. They get it. They understand why it's important and how they can make a meaningful impact in the lives of founders. And so that was wonderful. But just the exposure and the connections that we made through that program were really meaningful. And I met wonderful advisors and mentors through Innovation Factory. So I guess to any of the founders really who are considering, would they want to join a program or build in public or build with an accelerator, I would say it's not for everybody, but consider that the amount of doors that will be opened with every one connection you make, those people are connected to tens and hundreds of more people. And it's a great opportunity just to figure out who you need in your circle.
Yeah. Sometimes access is just everything.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yep.
It's not necessarily, you know, and this is the unfortunate truth about just the world and how it works. It's not necessarily what problems you're solving, but who knows what problems you're solving and do they care about it?
Yes. A lot of the tasks that I've had, I've heard, again, like I think we started off talking about education is this really big kind of hairy topic. A lot of people have a lot of opinions. A lot of people have experienced education firsthand. I think almost everybody hopefully has gone through some sort of school program. So they feel that they're invested to a certain degree, but there are also people who have kind of given up entirely on our school systems, plural, whether it's your local system where you send your kids. I talk to parents every day who feel like, I'm not comfortable or I'm not happy sending my kids to school. I don't feel like they're getting the education quality that they deserve. There might be challenges of their safety at risk. So there's some of those challenges where people are like, I'm giving up on our school system and I want to find a better way. But I don't have the energy, or I feel like we've heard the stories time and time again, and there's the same problems with teachers and the same problems with budgets and the same problem with, and people tune it out and just put their head down and focus on the problems that are kind of most imminent, most pressing to them.
Or just the loudest.
And so, yes, a lot of what I've had to do is just sort of scream from the rooftops, like, yes, there's a problem that you all are probably aware of ish. Some people are learning more about the nuances of the problem. As I go around and talk to people, there's an education piece to this problem.
Yeah.
But further than that, it's yes, we can identify the problem. A lot of us can point to it and say, that's a problem. But we don't always have really clear solutions in place. And for people who are out there solving some of the biggest world problems, like, you really have to fight and explain why your solution will cut through, will be different, will make that impact. And sometimes you don't know, right? You don't know 100%, like that's the unpredictability. But you better be pretty confident, at the very least, that you are going to put in everything you can to see this through. And if you get to the point where you're like, you know what, this isn't going to be the solution for whatever reason, you're going to be the one to get to that answer either way.
Yeah. And that's part of the entrepreneurial journey. And especially as a founder building something that new to the world, is you might think your solution is the solution to it, but I think what you're doing in terms of building with your customers that are using it and those users continually, that means you're going to build something of value because the feedback is there, the feedback loop, everything is continually being assessed, being used, tested, and then reassessing, improving as you go. And that's that slow spiral upwards, right?
Yeah.
Where you're going to hit that trajectory that you hope for with whatever you're building and hopefully with Colab as well.
Absolutely. I mean, we've already seen really great beyond groundswells of people who understand specifically the solution we have to this problem. And they, again, they really have, they see where we're going, they see where we're at, and they are jumping in and engaging with our platform. And we've got early customers, we've got users of all different kinds, free and paid customers, and pilots off the ground with various different education organizations. And that's really validating that people see where we're going and they see what we're trying to do. But they also know, like I said, we're partway there. There's so much more potential for us, and we're really happy to work in collaboration and make that possible. And a tricky thing with our space is our customers are not our users, and that's not always the case, right? We've got the teachers who use our platform entirely for free right now. And then even when they use the paid version from their school or district, they're not paying. I don't want them to pay. I never want teachers to pay for this. I want them to love this product, love this platform, and use this every day as a solution, but they're not the ones paying. And then that's another piece of, okay, who is paying and who actually sees this as a viable and valuable enough solution to a problem that they are a part of, but they don't necessarily experience in the same way. Mm-hmm. So it has been really interesting being on that other side and understanding sort of the array of people who are a part of this, the teachers, the principals, superintendents, the teaching associations that I work with, like all these different stakeholders. Mm-hmm. I now have a much broader understanding of how people can contribute to the solution that we're creating and why it's so important to get that feedback and build with them. And
in mind,
yeah, exactly.
Absolutely. So as we wrap the podcast, we have three questions we usually ask. The first one is, what is one thing you're leaving behind in your entrepreneurial journey?
I would say I want to leave behind self-doubt. I don't know if I am doing it yet.
Yeah.
But it's a goal, is to say, you know what, like the imposter syndrome is always there. Mm-hmm. But I would like to leave that behind because I feel like it kind of weighs you down when you're like, I do still say, I'm a teacher, I'm just a teacher, but like, I'm a founder and I've built a business and I'm a teacher, but I'm more than that, so.
Yeah, I love that. Leave it behind today.
I'll try.
I mean, it's always going to creep back in, but you're going to do it.
Thank you.
You're going to do it. All right, what's the biggest thing you've learned so far?
Biggest thing I've learned so far? Oof. That's tough. I would say
it could be anything. It doesn't have to be about business. It could be about yourself. It could be about the world. It could be about what you're actually building.
Yeah. I have learned that teaching is always going to be a difficult job. So like, although I am actively trying to improve the lives of teachers and improve the education system, I do feel like it's a fallacy to say that we are going to make teaching easy, or we are going to make schools run smoothly, or whatever it may be. I think if you're working with people and you're solving messy problems, the solutions are going to look messy too. And that's just not a realistic goal. So I would say, I do go out and say this quite a lot. I'm like, I don't think teaching will ever not be difficult, but I would like to make it possible. Mm-hmm. And I would like to make it the challenge fun. Like, you know, when you're experiencing those fun moments where you're like, this is really tough. Type 2 fun, I think, is, you know, like I'm on a hike and it kind of sucks, but then at the end it feels good.
Yeah.
Type 2 fun. There would also be great to have type 1 fun every day with teaching, right? Where you're like, this is just fun because it's fun. Mm-hmm. That's what I would like everybody to feel and experience when they are working with kids in like a vulnerable population across the board in their schools.
Yeah. And our final question is, what is one thing you're absolutely taking into the future with you?
I mean, it's a bit cliche, but I think the people that I've met, the network that I've built, I don't, like, of course, you can't keep every connection strong forever. And there's times and places for various people in your life. But the idea of fostering those connections and the various people that I've met, I think people are game changing and people are everything. So I'm driving forward with the best of the best, the people that I've met, mm-hmm. the network that I've built, and I'm keeping room for more people to join the network and join our mission. And I think people are everything. And it's no surprise that I'm building a way for teachers to connect with other people because it's so critical to success personally and professionally.
Yeah, I think overall, and I'm not the first person to say this, but we're the most connected, but also the most disconnected in so many ways.
Mm-hmm.
So I think communities that are specific and, you know, a lot of people use niche as a bad word, but I don't think it is. It really creates that sense of belonging for people, a sense of pride for people, and just a place to lean on to say, yes, I can take one more step. And that's all people need sometimes. And, you know, we do need teachers to be in their careers for longer than 4 years.
Yep.
And our future is determined by how well the young ones are being educated. So anything to bolster education and have people learn in a real way, I think is really important. I'm personally not a fan of, you know, how education, I think, has been structured in recent years.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I just learn differently. And I think the world and kids need more challenges than I think the systems are setting them up for.
Mm. That's a whole other podcast. That's
a whole other podcast.
Yeah.
The participation certificates are not, they're setting.
Trash them.
Yeah. They're setting kids up for failure, ultimately,
yeah.
As you come into the real world and they can't survive.
Yeah.
You know, I had someone tell me the other day they went on vacation and when they came back, their co-op student quit because they couldn't handle the workload with the few extra things that came onto their plate because their boss was away. And that's what a participation survey gets you.
Yeah. Yeah. I've seen many variations of that situation play out of students of all ages, in university, college, high school, and younger. And it's something that we really critically need to look at. And I think teachers, it depends, right? There's a huge range. If you've been teaching for 35 years, you have seen a huge change in transition of the system and how students are being taught in schools, how kids are learning at home and through the world around them.
Yeah.
There's just so many different, like, education is a very big word, and a lot of what education means has shifted. People are not just learning from school and don't see it as the yeah. only place to gain knowledge. If anything, I feel like it's been knocked down 10 tiers,
yeah.
10 pegs of, you know what? School is not where you're going to learn how to live and do everything
yeah.
in your life. The skills, the competencies are not just yeah. going to come from this traditional place.
I think
place.
The only role school really has is a place where you teach people how to learn, which is asking questions versus memorizing.
Yeah, the metacognition of
yeah.
it all, right?
Versus memorizing and just moving people through a system
yep.
like checkpoints.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a lot of a huge shift happening across Canada of alternative schooling
mm-hmm.
and various different, like, homeschooling and micro schools and all these different variations. And I think it's because people are seeking ways to come out feeling like their child, their student is coming out with competencies and skills to succeed. Yeah. And if you're not getting that in, you know, a traditional school setting, where else or how else can we gain these skills and competencies? And with the world and technology and everything happening around us moving fast, it's about, okay, what do you actually need and how do we make sure people are set up for success? So I think that's a big question that everybody who's working in schools today needs to think about personally and their role individually. And like I mentioned, yes, we've got big system problems, but it takes individuals in the system to make those changes and to start now of thinking, what are we going to do differently and better? Mm-hmm. And it can start with an individual, even if it feels like you're making small steps. It's better than nothing.
It is. Well, that's not our problem to solve.
Not today, at
not
least.
Not today. But it's been such a pleasure chatting with you.
You as well.
I've learned so much about you, and I can't wait to see where CoLab goes next. And if there are any teachers, we have people listening in, you know, how many countries? Like tons of countries.
It's amazing and super impressive.
So it's really amazing. And if you cater to teachers globally, why not? If you are a teacher, you know a teacher, tell them to sign on to CoLab Education and see if they can help Ariella build even further.
Yes, thank you. Feedback welcome. Thank you so much, Shalesa. I so appreciate the time, the energy, and the space to have this conversation.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks for tuning in, everyone. We're so glad to have you as part of our Buzzworthy community as we grow our network of Buzzworthy businesses. Continue to follow us on all the social media platforms at Buzzworthy_pod and follow us on whatever platform you're listening to so that you can get the new episodes as soon as they're out. This Buzzworthy podcast could not be done without our incredible team, starting with our music by Khaled Imam, our video and sound engineer, James Clark, Yvette Robichaud, our social media manager, Cesar Cardenia, our brand and creative lead, and finally, your host and executive producer, Shalesa Harris. We'll see you next week.